Friday, March 28, 2026. Welcome to the Daily Tech Feed. Today's stack is genuinely weird in the best possible way. CERN is burning tiny AI models directly into silicon to filter particle collision data in real time. We're talking physics at the speed of physics. AMD just crammed 28 megabytes of cache into a single chip, and I have questions about the laws of thermodynamics. The Go ecosystem is pushing hard on agents, with some sharp thinking about where state should actually live. Someone made macOS consistently bad on purpose. And it's more interesting than it sounds. And Montedisco is quietly rethinking how we find data in a decentralized world, which matters more than the name suggests. Lot of ground to cover. Let's go. Story 1. CERN uses tiny AI models burned into silicon for real-time LHC data filtering. The Large Hadron Collider produces roughly a petabyte of data per second. 1 petabyte every second. You cannot store that. You cannot transmit it. You have to make decisions. Right now, in hardware, at the speed of physics, about what matters and what gets thrown away forever. That's the filtering problem, and for decades, the solution was classical triggers. Hand-coded logic, rule-based systems. Physicists literally writing down what they thought a Higgs boson signature should look like before they'd seen one. You're hunting for needles by describing the needle in advance and hoping you got the description right. What CERN has done here is something genuinely different. They've trained tiny AI models, inference at the edge stuff, stripped down to run on FPGAs and ASICs, and burned them directly into silicon. The model isn't running on a server somewhere waiting for data to arrive. The model is the detector hardware. Decision latency measured in nanoseconds. Inference at the collision point. Let's pull this thread. The traditional AI deployment story goes. Big model, cloud server, send data up, get answer back. That loop has latency. It has bandwidth requirements. It has a physical data center with a power bill somewhere. What CERN is demonstrating is the opposite architecture. Shrink the model until it fits in the gate array. Co-locate it with the sensor. Eliminate the round trip entirely. The intelligence moves to the data instead of the data moving to the intelligence. This matters far beyond particle physics. Think edge computing for environmental sensors. Think satellite onboard processing. Think medical devices that can't afford the latency of a network call. Think any situation where you're generating more raw signal than any pipe can carry, and you need to know right now what's worth keeping. The other thing worth noting, these models are open. CERN publishes. The frameworks they're using, HLS4 milliliter, FastML, are community projects. The knowledge of how to squeeze a neural network into a few thousand logic gates is becoming a shared resource. That's the pattern, hard problem, constrained hardware, open methodology, published results. The tools exist. The knowledge is available. And now someone's done it at the most data-dense experiment humans have ever built. That's a proof of concept worth paying attention to. It turns out knowing something is possible changes how you think about building for it. Here's story 2 script. There's a piece of advice floating out of Stanford right now that sounds almost too simple. Go hard on agents, not on your file saver. Sit with that for a second. Because if you've spent any time building with LLM-based systems, you know the instinct. Something needs to persist. Write a file. Something needs to be retrieved. Read a file. The file system is familiar. It's legible. It's been the backbone of software architecture for 50 years. But here's what's changing. Agents aren't just wrappers around language models anymore. They're becoming the unit of computation itself. And when you design around that reality instead of fighting it, something interesting happens. You stop thinking about data at rest and start thinking about reasoning in motion. The false system metaphor was built for a world where state was expensive to compute and cheap to store. That calculus is flipping. Inference is getting faster and cheaper by the month. What's actually costly now is coordination overhead. The cognitive tax of shuttling context in and out of flat files, managing stale reads, reconciling writes from multiple processes that don't know about each other. Agents solve a different class of problem. They carry context. They can be interrupted, resumed, composed. They reason about their own state rather than externalizing it to disk. And crucially, they can talk to each other without a file system intermediary. This is the architectural shift that matters, not a why does your job for you. That's a consumer story. The engineering story is, what does software look like when reasoning is a first-class primitive? The people building at Stanford's SCS aren't just playing with demos. They're working through the actual design patterns. When do you reach for an agent versus a file? How do you handle persistence in a system that's meant to think? Where does durable state live when your primary abstraction is ephemeral by design? These are the questions that will shape the tooling for the next decade. The file system isn't going away, but it's being demoted from the central organizing metaphor of software to one tool among many, and in its place, something more dynamic, more alive. That's worth paying attention to. Run this forward. That instinct to design for interconnection extends beyond software. Hardware architects are thinking about it too, just at a different scale. 208 megabytes of cache on a single consumer chip. Let that land for a second. AMD just dropped the Ryzen 9 9950Pi 3D2 Dual Edition, and the number that keeps pulling my attention isn't the core count or the clock speed. It's that cache figure, 208 MB of L3. That's not a spec sheet flex. That's an architectural statement about where computing is heading. Here's the context. AMD's 3DV cache technology stacks, additional cache directly on top of the processor, die like building a second floor instead of expanding the footprint. The original implementation was already a revelation for gaming workloads. The idea was simple and devastating. The bottleneck in modern processors often isn't the compute. It's the memory latency. Data has to travel off-chip to RAM and back. And that round trip costs you. Bring the data closer. Stack it on top of the cores themselves. And suddenly, you're not waiting. You're computing. The Dual Edition takes that logic and doubles it. Two stacks, two chiplets worth of 3DV cache, unified into one coherent pool. 208 MBB sitting right there, within reach of every core. The workloads that benefit from this are worth naming. Games that stream large world data. Simulation software that needs to hold complex state in hot memory. AI inference, running models locally, where the weights need to stay resident without constant DRAM thrash. Scientific computing, video processing pipelines. Anything where the dataset matters as much as the math. What I find genuinely exciting here isn't just the performance numbers, though they're going to be absurd. It's that AMD keeps finding ways to extract more capability from the same fabrication nodes by being clever about silicon architecture. This is the kind of engineering that doesn't require a new process node. It requires creativity. Stack the cache. Solve the latency problem at the packaging layer. The gap between a well-specs workstation and a data center node keeps narrowing. Not because servers are getting cheaper, because consumer chips are getting architecturally serious. 208 megabytes. right there on your desk. The tools keep improving. That's the story. What makes that curve so sharp is how much of it now fits in consumer hardware, which makes the next story hit differently. Because when the software experience doesn't keep pace, that gap starts to sting. Here's a person who looked at their screen, noticed something genuinely inconsistent, and decided to fix it. That's the whole story. And somehow, in 2026, that's still remarkable. The issue is corner radius. macOS 26 applies rounded corners to most windows. But not all of them. Some apps get rounded, some don't. The result is this subtle visual dissonance that lives just below conscious awareness. The kind of thing you can't unsee once you notice it. A UI that's supposed to feel cohesive, but doesn't. The obvious fix is to disable SIP, System Integrity Protection, and just strip the rounding out at the system level, but that's a sledgehammer. SIP exists for real reasons. You don't want to nuke your security model because Apple has inconsistent design opinions. So this person did something more interesting. Objective-C method, swizzling. A dlib that injects into user space apps at launch, intercepts the window corner radiosom's calls, and sets everything to 23.0 uniform. Consistent, SIP stays on, the system remains intact. You've just quietly fixed the part that was annoying you. This is the kind of solution that requires actually understanding what you're working with. Not just, here's a setting. Not just, here's a toggle. You have to know how the runtime works, how method dispatch works, how to reach into a process without breaking it. That's real knowledge, applied to a real problem, producing a real result. And the target here isn't just a quirky preference. The author's pointing at something broader. The cargo culting of UI design. Apple decides rounded corners are good, so rounded corners go everywhere. Inconsistently, without regard for whether the design actually holds together. Aesthetic homogenization masquerading as polish. The response isn't to complain about Apple. The response is to own your own machine. That's the part worth sitting with. Your computer is yours. The software running on it can be modified, extended, redirected, carefully, thoughtfully, within the constraints that matter. You don't have to accept the defaults. You don't have to file a bug report and wait 3 years. You can just fix it. The tools for this have always existed. What changes whether people use them? This person did. Shared the code, made it reproducible. That's the loop. Individual insight becomes collective capability. Your desktop, your rules. That's the power of open source. A small fix, freely shared, becomes someone else's foundation. Which brings us to a different kind of infrastructure problem. Here's the script for story 5. Data discovery is one of those problems that sounds boring until you actually hit it. And then it's all you think about. You have data. Someone else has data. Maybe those two data sets combined answer a question neither of you could answer alone. But how do you find each other? How do you even know the other data set exists? The current answer is you don't. Not reliably. You search Google, you ask around, you post on forums, you hope someone mentions it in a footnote. Or you go through a centralized catalog, some platform that decided it gets to be the index of REH cord. And you trust that their incentives align with yours. They usually don't. Metadisco is a different answer. Decentralized data discovery. The idea, metadata about datasets shouldn't live in one place, controlled by one entity. It should be distributed, discoverable, composable, more like DNS than like Google Drive. The data can live anywhere. The knowledge that the data exists, what it contains, how it's structured, who made it, that propagates through the network. Run this forward. Researchers in different institutions, different countries, even. Able to find each other's work without going through a central broker. Scientists publishing datasets that are immediately discoverable by anyone building on similar foundations. Open data projects that don't require a corporate middleman to make them findable. The catalog becomes a commons, not a product. This is genuinely hard to build. Decentralized systems that are also usable are a narrow target. But the alternative, letting a handful of platforms own the index of human knowledge, is a slow-motion disaster. Whoever controls discovery controls what gets found. What gets found shapes what gets built. That's too much leverage to leave in too few hands. What I find exciting here is the underlying bet that the value of data compounds when it can connect. A dataset sitting in isolation is useful. A dataset that knows about 10,000 related datasets and can be found by anyone who needs it. That's infrastructure. That's the kind of thing that changes what research is possible. The tools for this are maturing. The protocols exist. What's needed is adoption. People choosing to publish metadata into the open graph instead of the walled garden. Matadisco is building toward that. Worth watching. From indexing what we know to protecting what we might lose. The commons has many rooms. There's a piece on Hacker News today from a naturalist's blog, Bear Blog, for what it's worth, which is the kind of platform that exists because someone decided the web should be simple and open again. And the title alone stopped me cold. The bee that everyone wants to save, that framing is doing a lot of work. Not the bee we need to save. Everyone wants to. There's something in that distinction worth sitting with. The bee in question is almost certainly a bumblebee, probably Bombus something, one of the dozens of species that have been quietly disappearing from North American and European landscapes over the past few decades. Bumblebees are, taxonomically speaking, the golden retrievers of the insect world. Fuzzy, round, slow enough to observe, crucial to wild plant reproduction in ways that honeybees, which get all the press, simply aren't. Honeybees are agricultural. Bumblebees are ecological. And here's what's interesting about the conservation story around them. It isn't just scientists. It's gardeners, backyard naturalists, people with iNaturalist accounts, and an afternoon despair. The data infrastructure for tracking bumblebee decline is genuinely open. Citizen science projects have contributed millions of observation records. The knowledge is distributed because the observers are distributed, because someone, somewhere, decided that scientific observation shouldn't require a university affiliation. That's the thread worth pulling. The bee everyone wants to save exists inside a much larger story about who gets to participate in understanding the natural world. For most of human history, that was specialists with institutional access. Then the internet happened. Then cheap cameras happened. Then platforms for aggregating and publishing observation data happened. Openly, freely, for anyone with eyes and curiosity. The naturalist writing this piece is working in that tradition. A Bear Blog. No ads, no paywall, no editorial board. Just someone who knows bees and wanted to share what they know with whoever might care. That's the kind of thing that matters. Not because it's going to single-handedly reverse pollinator decline. It won't. But because the distributed attention of people who care, equipped with the tools to record and share what they observe, is genuinely one of the better things humanity has figured out how to do. The bee has a lot of fans. Turns out that's not nothing. There's something in there, the way attention, once earned with court forms, compounds. Here's something small that might actually change how you read the internet. Hacker News has always had a trust problem, not in the dramatic Twitter collapse sense, but in the quieter, more interesting sense. You read a comment. It sounds authoritative. You check the username, account created 3 weeks ago, Karma of 42. Is that a thoughtful newcomer or a sock puppet? You genuinely can't tell. The signal is too coarse. Trust Signals as Spark Lines is a project that tries to fix that with one elegant idea. Show the history, not just the score. Spark Lines, those tiny word-sized charts, Edward Toft basically invented the apothe of the vocabulary for, are perfect for this. You don't need a dashboard. You don't need to click through to a profile page. You just need a thumbnail of the shape of someone's participation over time. Are they consistent? Did they appear suddenly and immediately start arguing? Do they comment broadly or only in one narrow domain? Does their karma trend up, down, sideways? That shape carries information. A lot of it. What I find genuinely exciting here is the epistemology. We've spent years trying to solve online trust by building more elaborate gatekeeping. Verification check marks, identity requirements, real name policies. Most of it made things worse or just moved the problem. This approach goes the other direction. Don't gate, illuminate. Make the history legible. Let readers do the inference. It's the same instinct behind open source reputation systems, behind commit history being public, behind showing your work. Transparency is the trust mechanism, not authority. The other thing worth noting, this is a third-party tool built by someone who just wanted this to exist. That's how Hacker News has always worked at its best. The community extends the platform because they care about the quality of the conversation. Someone saw a gap, thought about it carefully, and built the smallest possible version of a solution. Run this forward, and you can imagine Trust Signals becoming standard UI, not just for HN, but anywhere online discourse happens. Not a score, not a badge, a shape, the shape of how someone shows up over time. That's information you can actually use. And sometimes the community getting better looks like a small act of naming, calling a thing what it actually is. Story 8, Go Naming Conventions, a practical guide. Here's something that might sound boring until it isn't. The rules Go programmers follow when naming things are a small masterpiece of language design philosophy. Alex Edwards put together a practical guide on this, and it's worth pulling apart. Not because naming conventions are glamorous, but because the choices Go made reveal something about how the language thinks about human cognition and code as communication. Go has a principle that feels almost counterintuitive at first. Shorter names for tighter scopes. An index variable in a three-line loop. I is perfect. A variable living across a 100-line function. Now you earn a descriptive name. The logic is clean. The shorter the scope, the less context you need to carry. Your brain holds it in working memory just fine. Push that same logic upward, and suddenly, you're writing user account balance after feeduction everywhere, which is its own kind of cognitive tax. Then there's the acronym rule. HTTP stays HTTP. URL stays URL. Not HTTP, not URL. This sounds trivial until you're reading someone else's code at midnight and your eyes snag on HTTP URL, one half screaming, one half whispering. Go said, pick a lane. Everything uppercase, always. Consistency beats elegance here. The interface naming convention is probably my favorite. If your interface has one method, name the interface after that method with an suffix. A thing that reads is a reader. A thing that writes is a writer. A thing that formats itself as a string is a stringer. This is almost Borges level elegance. The type is the behavior linguistically. You read the interface name and you already know what it does. No ambiguity. What's actually happening here is that Go made a bet that code is read far more than it's written, and that reading costs are real. Conventions reduce those costs. Not through rigid rules handed down from on high, but through community consensus that calcified into culture, then into tooling, then into how new Go developers learn to think. This is how open source builds shared cognition. One blog post, one convention, one code base at a time, until a critical mass of humans are writing in a way that other humans can read without friction. That's not a small thing. That's craft becoming culture. And sometimes the most useful thing someone can do is point at what's already there. That instinct, making the familiar more accessible. It shows up in different forms. Here's something that sounds incremental but is actually kind of elegant. LG has a new display panel that can drop its refresh rate all the way down to 1 hertz, 1 frame per second. And before you ask, yes, that's intentional, and yes, it's the whole point. Here's the physics. Your laptop display is refreshing itself constantly, 60 times a second, 120 times a second, sometimes more. It does this whether you're watching a video, playing a game, or just staring at a document you haven't touched in 4 minutes. The display doesn't know the difference. It just keeps firing. That's a lot of energy spent on nothing. Variable refresh rate technology has been around for a while. It's how gaming monitors match frame output to reduce tearing. But dropping to 1 hertz is a different application entirely. When content is static, a PDF, a spreadsheet, a terminal you're reading and thinking about, the display now has permission to almost stop. 1 refresh per second. Enough to catch any change, not enough to waste meaningful power. The result is real battery life gains, not marketing real, actually real. The laptop LG is pairing this with reportedly hits substantially longer runtimes, precisely because the display, historically one of the biggest power draws on any portable machine, knows when to breathe. Run this forward. This is how efficiency compounds. You don't always need a bigger battery. Sometimes you need smarter hardware that respects what you're actually doing. The display paying attention to its context rather than just hammering at maximum effort, regardless. That's good engineering. That's the display earning its place in the system. There's a broader principle here worth naming. The gains from intelligent power management across displays, processors, radios, storage are starting to stack in ways that are genuinely changing what portable computing feels like. Not incrementally, in ways you notice. All-day battery used to mean compromise. Now it means the hardware finally caught up to how people actually use these things. And the components driving it, like this LG panel, are increasingly available to any manufacturer willing to build around them. That's the other win. Good ideas don't stay proprietary forever. They become the floor everyone builds on 1 hertz. 1 frame per second when you don't need more. Sometimes the smart move is knowing when to stop. The kind of thinking that makes tech disappear into the background. Until suddenly, you notice your battery is still at 80% at dinner time. Speaking of things you might not have noticed yet. Last story, and it's a good one to end on, because it's small. Small things are often where the real signal lives. Twitch has a discovery problem. The algorithm does what algorithms do. It feeds you what's already winning. The top 100 streamers on any given night are swimming in viewers. The next 10,000? Invisible. Not because they're bad. Not because nobody would enjoy them. Just because the math of attention works like compound interest. The rich get richer, and everyone else streams into the void. Twitch Roulette is a one-page web app that fixes this. You click a button, it finds you a live streamer, right now broadcasting, who is almost nobody watching. Could be one viewer, could be zero. Just someone, somewhere, live on the internet, doing their thing for an empty room, and then you show up. There's something genuinely moving about that. Think about the person on the other end. They set up their stream, they hit go, they're playing their game, or cooking their meal, or explaining their niche hobby to what they assume is nobody. And then, the viewer count ticks up. One person found them, not because an algorithm decided they were worth surfacing, because a tool built by someone who cared about this problem made the connection. That's the whole thing. That's the whole pitch. The builder of Twitch Roulette didn't wait for Twitch to fix its discovery problem. They built around it. One small app, no drama, just, here's the gap, here's the fix, go use it. This is how independent builders work. Not asking permission, not filing feature requests. Just building the thing that should exist. And what it reveals, incidentally, is something true about attention economies. Concentration isn't inevitable. It's a default that persists when nobody intervenes. Intervene, and the whole landscape changes. The long tail of the internet. The weird, the niche, the genuinely interesting. It's still there. It's just waiting to be found. The tools exist, the knowledge is available, and sometimes the intervention is as simple as a randomized button and a willingness to land somewhere unexpected. Click it. See who's out there. You might find your new favorite thing. That's the Daily Tech Feed for today. Stay curious. That's the feed for March 28th, 2026. Every story today was a reminder that the tools are getting better, the knowledge is getting freer, and the people building are moving fast. That combination is genuinely exciting. Keep building, keep sharing, keep reading the things that make you smarter. This episode was generated by Claude Opus 4.6, voiced by Jack on the Daily Tech Feed. If something landed today, send it to someone who'd care. That's how the signal spreads. Find DTFHN on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts are distributed. See you tomorrow.